Merhaba, l-episodju ieħor fih dan is-sensiela il-Fakulta tal-Mużika. Il-ġimgħa li għaddiet kellna diskussjoni interessanti ħafna mal-mużiċist u d-double bassist Deacon Cooper fejn ħadna ftit fuq l-istorja ta' dak li nsejħu l-jazz double bass. U din il-ġimgħa il għaliex tant kienet interessanti l-istorja ta' double bass ser nkomplu nisimgħu u niskopru iktar dwar l-istorja ta' dan l-istrument tant interessanti. Deacon, welcome back to the episode. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for having me back.
My pleasure, my pleasure. So as I was just saying, because last week, time is a musician's biggest enemy, and same goes in here, and we're going to continue discussing and learning a little bit more about the jazz double bass. I believe we're just starting the integration of the double bass within the jazz sphere. We had definitely started it, but I think it's good to continue from where we left off last week as with regards the 1930s and 1940s.
Sure. Well, last week we discussed how the double bass players would use slap bass in order to create greater sound, in order to give more rhythmic interest to the bass line. And because of the nature of recording of early jazz used to use the tuba a lot, it took them a while before they ended up having a recording of this particular technique. So the earliest recording comes from 1926, and it's called Dinah, and the double bass player is Steve Brown. And this is, I think, the earliest example of slap bass that we have on record. But it also serves as a great example of what slap bass sounds like, still sounds like today, when they use it in rockabilly or bluegrass.
It's perfect. Let's go to listen to it. Thank you, Deacon, for letting us know about that piece of music. It was a fantastic example of how slap bass is used in jazz. Now, I'll leave it up to you once again to continue taking us on this journey of exploration of the history of the jazz double bass.
Well, there were many other innovators, so it's always quite difficult to choose one. And of course, you know, we always talk about individual double bass players. We always talk about individual musicians as being sort of key figures. But we also have to remember that it's not always just this one guy, or it's a sort of part of a movement. There were loads of people changing the way that double bass was playing, turning up to gigs every week and doing their own thing. And it's only really these key people who stand out because they just... they either played with amazing people, or they just had something slightly extra. So after the 1920s, well, towards the end of the 1920s, the big band era came, and big band music was enormously popular. Big bands toured the USA, playing in dance halls, because you know, at this time, amplified music and recorded music was still quite difficult to come by, and if you wanted to fill a large room, you needed quite a lot of musicians. So the big band sort of worked very well in that context. And during this time, one of the great innovators in big band music, who sort of elevated big band music from what you might call dance hall to almost an art form, was Duke Ellington. And when he was touring, once he went to a few jam sessions, and he came across a bass player called Jimmy Blanton, who was very young at this time, I think about 18, and he was so impressed with his bass playing that he offered him the job of the Duke Ellington Orchestra on the spot, which was pretty much like walking straight into the highest job you could get in anything in jazz at this time. Before Duke Ellington got Jimmy Blanton, they used to use more than one double bass player so that they could fill out the sound, because then that would solve the problem of amplification. So if you use two double bass players playing the same notes, then you got double the volume, more or less. And but when Duke Ellington appointed Jimmy Blanton, he found that he was strong enough that he could make such a big sound on his bass that he didn't need any amplification at all. And that also gave Jimmy Blanton greater freedom, because then he didn't actually have to play according to a piece of music. He didn't actually have to follow the script. He could have a more improvisatory approach to double bass playing. And pretty soon, what Duke Ellington realised is that he had someone who had really great talent, and he showed this by doing some recordings where it's just double bass and piano, which was the first time that this happened. Now, one of the things which Jimmy Blanton also introduced was the occasional bass solo. And we have a recording of one of these. These are quite rare, but they sort of showed, they do give a very good example of Jimmy Blanton's versatility. So if we can listen to that one, that would be quite a good point.
Once again, thank you very much, Dickin, for letting us know about that particular track. We can definitely hear the difference in the two playing styles now, and we're going to more improvisatory, more free bass. I believe, Dickin, as I've done previously, it's time to let you do your thing and continue the wonderful story.
What's impressive on that clip is that you can really hear the force with which he hits the strings, and you can hear the tone that he gets out of his bass. I mean, because that sounds very acoustic. It's just recorded with a microphone in a room rather than close up with a pickup like we would do today. So he really needed to play very hard. And the fact that he's actually playing with such accuracy at the same time is impressive from a bass player's perspective.
When you point it out, I think it really does make a difference in the way that the bass sounds when you tackle it in this sort of way. So thank you for bringing that to our attention, Dickin.
Yes. So after Jimmy Blanton, bass players started using, or more regularly started using the pickups or amplification where they just put a microphone right next to the double bass to try and pick it up. And that changed the style a little bit more, but it also meant that big band music could only use one double basses, and it was possible for the double basses to hold their own. However, around this time, jazz music started changing again, where the big band music became less popular in the 1940s, and bebop started playing. And bebop was marked by extremely fast playing, although it's not only about playing fast, a focus on improvisation and a more democratic arrangement between the instruments. And because it was a more democratic arrangement between the instruments, what emerged at this point was a need for double bass players to play solos, more like the Jimmy Blanton, but in a bebop style, which meant that they had to play almost in a similar way of a sax player, or at least develop their own bebop style. And one of the early innovators in this area was Oscar Pettiford, who was still sort of immersed in the traditional jazz style, but began to compose his own pieces and sort of lead his own groups, and most significantly actually play the melodies on his pieces. And he's one of the first people who really introduced a bebop style in terms of playing his own solos. Now, a bebop style, I mean, it's very difficult, and I'll probably, you know, get letters if I try and define it in any way, but let's say it is defined a little bit more by playing according to what, playing a melody, improvising a melody according to the chords, according to the harmony, rather than the actual tune. So in many cases, the solo will have nothing whatsoever to do with the tune of the piece at all. All you do is use the chords in order to improvise the, in order to create a solo. And the other aspect in which it may be slightly different is that the chords move very quickly. You know, you can change key literally in a nanosecond, and you have to respond to that in your improvisation. So Oscar Pettiford was one of the first people who could really thrive in this new environment for bass players. And one of his most famous pieces is called Trichotism. Now, rather than play one of the solos, what we have here is where he did a recording, and you may have to listen hard if you're in the car or anything like that, because he's playing the melody underneath the sax player, and it's but he's still sort of holding his own, actually playing his own tune.
What we heard there was a piece of music in the style of bebop. As you've correctly said, Dickin, bebop was a style which was characterized by a lot of chord changes. And just to make a little caveat about the style we're talking about, just in case there is, you know, a listener who is not that familiar with jazz, bebop was a style of music that wasn't really intended for dancing. It wasn't a mainstream form of music. It was more of a virtuosic kind of musical style that allowed musicians to play faster, to show off certain skills, to improvise more based on changing chords, which allowed them to express more creativity in their art. And now I think the history of the double bass definitely continues and takes different approaches, which I will leave up to you to continue taking us on this journey.
So from the 1940s to the 1950s, at least in America, jazz music reigned supreme. It began to be overtaken by rock and roll towards the end of this period, but it was the dominant music form. It was extraordinarily popular, and this was one of the great periods where many of the names that we associate with jazz came to the fore and continue to dominate into the 60s, but it's slightly different ways. So in the 1950s, the jazz double bass players began to continue to play bebop, but they also introduced modal jazz. Modal jazz was similar to bebop, but in some ways, but was characterized by being slightly slower and had fewer changes. But the emphasis upon musicianship and the emphasis upon the small group setting and the sort of democratic arrangement between the different musicians remained without there being sort of a huge change in the way that it was listened to. So one of the key figures in this time was Ray Brown. Ray Brown is one of my personal favorites because he has an amazing swing feel. He has an amazing time. In fact, he has all the things that I aspire to as in a bass player. He played most famously with the Oscar Peterson Trio, where he, which was extraordinarily popular in the late 50s and the 1960s. So he was sort of the backbone of that particular group. But he had this particular style of being able to root his playing in the music without going too far away from it. So he never really lost the essence of what it means to be a bass player. In fact, he's very famous for saying, if you ever forget what you're actually there to do, you're not going to do very well. In other words, he says, what you're there is to hold down the rhythm, you're there to play in tune, you're there to play in time. You're not there to play complicated, amazing pieces. Now, the fact that he said that didn't mean that he wasn't able to produce great solo when it came to it. And so one of the little snippets that we have to listen to him is a solo that he did on a tune called Crazyology. And I think this sort of shows his sort of real adherence to the blues, his real sense of timing, and his ability to just turn out a great solo whenever he was asked for. So what you could hear in that, compared to some of the earlier pieces, is that clearly by this point, Rayburn has started using metal strings, and that's why he has such a sort of almost metallic tone, and that allows him to slide into the notes in a cleaner fashion than you would hear in the earlier pieces. So if you think back to the slap bass, that had a very dry percussive sound, whereas this has greater resonance, this sort of carries more, and this allows sort of greater expression in the way that he's playing that solo. But it's also interesting to hear just how great Oscar Peterson is in that clip, because even though the piano doesn't do very much, he's stepping back. And if you've ever heard Oscar Peterson play the piano, Oscar rarely takes a back seat, but he will when he's actually playing. But in this case, he just plays the chord. He lets Rayburn do his thing. And he gives him enormous amounts of space. And Rayburn is up to the job, obviously, and fills it perfectly. So at this point in the story of double bass, we're sort of like in the 1950s, 1960s. And we've mentioned the development of modal jazz. And towards this point, we also have free jazz, where musicians essentially got rid of the chords sequence entirely and played whatever they felt like. I mean, that's kind of a very flippant description. There's slightly more to it than that, but in general, that's pretty much what it entailed. And the double bass no longer had to carry on doing its traditional role. It didn't necessarily need to hold down the low end. It didn't need to play walking bass all the time. And the musician who really took this to what we might call an extreme is Scott LaFaro. And the thing about his playing is that he just manages to stay on the edge. He is able to play melodic bass without it ever coming to a point where everyone says, well, what are you doing? You're just playing, high up all the time. No one's actually holding it down. He was able to sort of straddle the two roles very, very, very carefully. And he, like Rayburn, he was also very famous for playing in a trio, but in this case it was the Bill Evans Trio. And most famously it was Scott LaFaro, Paul Motion and on drums, and Bill Evans on piano. What Scott LaFaro did in the Bill Evans Trio was play what you might call simultaneous improvisation, where he's playing at the same time, he's playing almost a counter melody to the main melody. He's almost playing a solo at the same time as everyone else. He's playing a solo underneath the tunes. And to a certain extent, this shouldn't work. Because if I started doing this, I'm sure that everyone would be shaking their heads and saying, what are you doing? But Scott LaFaro had the music sensibility to do this. Bill Evans had the ability to know what he was doing and to give him space. And the whole trio works very, very well together. I mean, you must be extraordinarily accomplished to pull this off.
Happens with all aspects of life, Dickin. Technology and progress happens, and after this period, the double bass found itself evolving into the bass that is nowadays used in pop and sometimes even jazz music, which is the electric bass. Evolving from a necessity, as you have correctly said, of a need of more amplification, these two instruments, the double bass and the electric bass, which is also available in its jazz versions, remain cohabitating the jazz space. What makes each instrument different, and what goes into selecting which instrument is more appropriate for the occasion, for the music style, etc.? In short, what makes you select going to a gig with your double bass instead of with your electric bass and vice versa?
Well, the short answer is it depends on who's asking, but on who's done the booking. But no, I mean, that is a very, very good question. I mean, the what happens to jazz in the 1960s is a source of great debate. So, you know, we need several more programs to cover that. But perhaps the best way of describing it is that there's a splintering of different styles. And one of the styles that develops at this point is jazz funk, which is the most famous example is Herbie Hancock's Headhunters. And that uses electric bass. And then there's Weather Report with Jaco Pastorius, and then Miles Davis in the 1980s brings in Marcus Miller as a bass guitarist. So the bass guitar, which was invented in the 1950s and originally only used in sort of rock and roll because it was more portable, because it was had a better... it was easier to amplify than acoustic instruments. And it was, and then it became more suitable for rock music and that sort of thing. This found its place in jazz and sort of develops its own niche. And to a certain extent, there was also a degree to which the double bass was seen as old-fashioned in the 1960s and 70s, and it was only in the 1980s that it began to really gain a lot of ground back once people started playing the old styles. A little bit more, and once amplification became even easier, which meant that it wasn't so difficult. So the music style really depends on what really affects what you play. If you want a punchier sound, if you want greater clarity in the sound, then it's the electric bass is the bass guitar is your thing. If you want a sort of fuller, more rounded sound, if there's more approach to improvisation, then the double bass is probably more suitable. For me personally, if you're going to play swing music, I find the double bass is really works very well in that style. There are people who can play extremely well on the bass guitar and swing extremely well, but it doesn't feel, you don't have the same weight behind the fingers for me. So it doesn't work in the same way. But if you're playing anything funky, Advantage of the bass guitar is that you can move around the fretboard a lot quicker. You can play octaves a lot easier. You can do a lot of the you can play slap bass in a way which on the electric bass, which has a different quality than you play on the bass guitar, so it's best suited in that way.
And Dickon, as we reach the conclusion of today's program, earlier you mentioned that Ray Brown was one of your inspirations, and from here I can confirm publicly on air that you are a phenomenal bassist, and you definitely have my seal of approval as probably one of the best bassists that there is on the island. So I thank you for joining me today. It was a very, very interesting discussion about the history of the double bass. I'm sure we did leave out quite a few details, as happened on many programs. And as you have correctly said, we would need many, many more programs to definitely fill in all the details about the history of the double bass. But I thank you for joining me, Dickon. It was a very, very interesting program. And I wish you all the best for your musical endeavors.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for having me.
Pleasure.